Revelatio, Revelation, chapter 17. We just finished with the first half of verse 6, last class period. What is the point of Revelation chapter 17? So I said towards the end of last class. What? The destruction of the prostitute. That is the point. We've got to keep that in our minds. Where do I even get that crazy idea that that's what the chapter is about? Yeah, verse 1. Verse 1, chapter 17 says, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute." That's the purpose. Now, we're about ready to move in. We've already described the prostitute. She's wearing her purple, and she's drunk on the blood of the saints, and tattooed on her head is mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes, and the abominations of the world, and she's flaunting around her gold cup that's filled with all kinds of atrocities. We've met her. We don't know who she is yet, but we've met her. All we know is that this figure is going to be destroyed, and we are going to see how that happens. Okay? You've got to keep that in your mind over the next 10 verses. Because boy, will you want to just do some crazy stuff with it. You've got to keep it in mind. The next 10 verses are still continuing what was said in verse 1. We're going to talk about the destruction of the prostitute. That is the point. So you see the forest? You see it? Let's not get lost in the trees, okay? Look at the whole picture. Here we go. Revelation chapter 17. I'm going to get a running start. We're going to start in verse 1, even though we ended at the halfway through verse 6. "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth dwellers, were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. Then I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls," basically wearing a miniskirt with thigh-high boots. Get the point? "She held the golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead, 'Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth.' I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints," the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. Ooh, the moment that you see that line, what do you think initially? Not just the death, but what do you think initially about her? Especially in light of chapter 14, especially in light of chapter 12. If she is drunk on the blood of the saints, what are you thinking? She's an enemy of God. Yeah, exactly. And what's her destiny? Yeah. Chapter 14, my word, the people that persecuted and killed the people of God, what was their fate in chapter 14? Yeah. They're the grapes that God is chomping on whenever he's developing wine in the winepress of his fury. Oh my. That is, yeah. You don't want to be drunk on the blood of the saints. You don't want to drink the blood of the saints. You don't want to have that on your resume. It's not good. Okay, second half. Here we go. "When I saw her, I was greatly astonished." Naturally. Naturally. John is actually, I love, one of the things I love about Revelation, maybe this is something I should do for the next inductive study, somebody can do, just the emotions of John, or the asides of John. Revelation is intended to attack our emotions, because that's what a lot of times we have to tap into our emotions so that it can actually discipline our logic. You know what I mean by that? Man, a lot of times it's like, hey, that doesn't make any sense. And yet our emotions sometimes needs to override what makes sense or doesn't make sense. That's necessary. And these churches in Asia Minor that are going through persecution, it makes good sense for them to sit down and shut up and not say anything. And yet John is trying to attack their emotions so that they ignite and it overrides their logic and they become what God wants them to begin with. I love this though, that John even just says, "I saw her and I was just blown away. I just couldn't believe it." I mean, think about what he's seen. This woman riding on the beast, and she's overwhelmed with the adulteries, and she's drinking a cup, and literally she's drinking it like, you know, guzzling the blood of the saints that's probably dripping down her chin. And on her forehead as she wipes it away, he sees mother of prostitutes, Babylon the Great. And he's thinking, the blood she's drinking are some of my friends, or some of my forefathers. And in that moment, John's just overwhelmed, naturally. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished?" Oh, silly angels. It's kind of like the angel in chapter 7. He's like, "Who are those that, you know, that are wearing the white robes, the great multitude?" And John's like, you know. you know the answer to that. He's like, "Yeah, but I'm asking you. Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery." I don't know if there's a major pause there between the question mark and the word "I." Why are you astonished? And if John truly was astonished, he may not even have words to say. All right, I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. Okay, what is the point of chapter 17?
The punishment.
Okay? Now, the 7 heads and 10 horns, why is he bringing that up? To chapter 13. This is something interesting too, because I'm wrestling more with the Leviathan Behemoth thing. I still, even if Leviathan and Behemoth are in some sense the background of the beast in Revelation 13, Daniel is still, for me, the primary.
Oh, I jumped that ship.
Okay, good. That's interesting. Well, we'll talk about that more later. But here, this is one of the reasons. In chapter 17, he is hammering. He hammers over and over the 10 horns and the 7 heads. They're huge. Well, in chapter 7 of Daniel, if you add up all the heads of the beast, it's 7 heads. And one of them in particular has 10 horns. He's grabbing from Daniel and making a point that this is a kingdom. And we're going to talk about the destruction of the kingdom. But this, I think it also is pulling from Daniel from what other thing? Remember in Daniel, what was so shocking in Daniel was that he gives us these 4 kingdoms in the form of the beast in Daniel 7. But why at the very end, at the end of Daniel chapter 7, in around verse 26 or 28, Daniel sees the entire vision, even after he sees the one like a son of man coming and receiving the kingdom. Do you know what Daniel's reaction is at the very end of the vision? Distraught. Deeply saddened and overwhelmed. Why? Yeah. Because they're sitting here. And he's saying, yeah, it's going to get worse. There's more kingdoms and beasts to come. This one's going to be destroyed eventually, but it doesn't mean it's the end of everything. There's more to come. It just, they have the same mission. It's going to be similar to what's going to happen here in Revelation chapter 17. I want to tell you about the destruction of the prostitute, but I think he's also making it very clear the destruction of Rome isn't the end of the world. Although it kind of looks like it and feels like it for a lot of people. But we'll get to that in a minute. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to its destruction. Whoa, what is that? What is that doing? What's that? Yeah. And what do we call that? It's that fun P word. Yeah, it's a parody. Paradox. Paradoxically a parody. Yes. It is a parody. And the how so is, he is saying the eternality of God is to be greatly contrasted with the people that are claiming the same position of God. We will have many governments throughout history claiming the position that only God belongs to. Even today, we do. But all those countries have one thing in common. They once were not, they now are, and they will one day not be. They all are the same. And it's using that as a way of mirroring or contrasting who God is, the one who was and is to come. And this beast is no different than all the other ones. We'll get to that more in a while. But that's going to come up more than once here. He's emphasizing the limited reality of this particular entity. The abyss will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life. Where does the book of life come from? We've seen that image already once. We'll see it again later. Where have we seen it once already? You can give me a vague answer if you want. 13? It does talk about that there. Where else? That's exactly right. Where else? One of the letters. In either chapter 2 or 3. Those that overcome, their name will not be blotted out of the book of life. The Lamb's book of life. Okay? These are the people whose names are not written in it. And notice again, the inhabitants of the earth. What did I say was the number one name for people that were not belonging to God in Revelation? Earth dwellers. Why? Because that's where their allegiance lies. That's where their kingdom belongs. That's where it's built, on earth. And by contrast, where should your kingdom lie and your allegiances lie? Yeah, at least we could say not earth. At least. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished. Notice the play, the interaction there. John was just astonished, and then the angel says, "Why are you astonished?" Almost saying, "Don't be astonished." Why? Because the people that are to be astonished are the ones that are not belonging to God. And why will they be astonished? Because of the power of God. For He is the only one that astonishment belongs to. He is the only one. Just like fear. The creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. He switches it around a bit, but the same point is being made. He is limited. This calls for a mind of wisdom. At that, in verse 9, I'm going to ask you again, what is the point of chapter 17? The punishment of the prostitute. The destruction of the prostitute. Keep that in your mind. And so, if you do that, you will be called wise. This calls for a mind of wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. Ooh, if I'm sitting in John's audience, that's a major clue. Why? The city of Rome is known as the city of seven hills. City of seven hills. There are seven hills. I actually... Since my computer was stolen, I don't have the PowerPoint up, but you can Google it, look online, and you can find the seven hills of Rome listed. There's seven of them. Whenever he says the seven heads are the seven hills which the woman sits, he's given an identity marker. Even if he's not being blatant and explicit yet, he's still letting us know the direction in which we can interpret the woman. You following me? He's not come right out and said, Rome is the woman. Not yet. Although that's pretty close. That's pretty close. They are also seven kings. What does that tell me? Think hermeneutically here. The where I'm getting at is interpretive. What does that tell me? Just a general principle. If he says the seven heads of a beast, they literally would belong to a beast, right? Because that's who he's referring it to. They are... They equal seven hills. But they also equal seven kings. Yeah, what is this telling me about the book of Revelation? Symbols, friends. Symbols. So, I mean, how do you make this literal? I mean, help me, someone. It's impossible, because the point is, all of these are describing the exact same thing at the exact same time. The seven kings are the seven hills, which are the seven heads. And the seven hills are the seven kings, which are the seven heads. And the seven heads are the seven kings and the seven hills. See what I mean? No. Okay. But notice what he's doing. Is he changed topics yet? No. He's describing the destruction of the prostitute, which is... the seven heads, which is the seven hills, which is the seven kings. Okay? We following this? She's riding on the beast. Here we go. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. Okay. My word, this verse. People just take this and do whatever they want with it. It is unbelievable. Matter of fact... It's frustrating, because at this point people just try to take it and they do whatever they want with it. One of the examples, really, notice we've never talked about the issue of dating in Revelation. I've just asserted the date, 95-96. I said if you want to challenge me, that's fine. Go ahead by reading and whatever. I'm okay with that. This is one of the primary texts, though, of people that try to date Revelation before 70. Before 70. Why? Where do you think? First of all, what's significant about 70? Destruction of the temple. Now, why would this verse help their cause? Yeah, what they start doing is they say, okay, let's count the kings. So there's a couple of questions that they have to ask whenever they come to this particular analysis. Number one, they have to ask, where should the list of emperors begin? That's the first question they ask. What are my two options? Rome. Think Rome. Julius Caesar would be one. What would be the other one? Augustus. Because people try to make this fine, you know, hard... They basically say, well, Julius Caesar really wasn't the Caesar in the way that like Tiberius was later. And so maybe we shouldn't start with him. Maybe we should start with Augustus. And if we... Well, let me write the emperors up here. That way, you know, we'll put Caesar. Notice that that's Julius, so that... Well, I'll put J. Caesar that way. You can help me. Yeah. Hey. Yeah, but anyway. Okay, we're not going to go there. See? The Latin parallel wouldn't help us any on that. Okay, Augustus. After Augustus, we get Tiberius. After Tiberius, we go to Caligula. After Caligula, you go to Claudius. After Claudius is Nero. And then it gets sticky. How many do we have so far? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So, some people will say the five kings who were is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The one that now is Nero, and there is still one yet to come. That's how they do it. See how that works? So they would say Nero, since he reigned from 54 to 68, it would mean the book of Revelation was written in this time period. Probably at the end. Remember in 64, whenever mass persecution was breaking out against the Christians in the city of Rome? Notice that though. Notice what I said there. In the city of Rome, not over the whole Roman Empire, in the city of Rome. This is written to the Christians in Asia Minor, not Roman Christians, in the city of Rome. You hear what I'm saying? It's a critique, as I explain, in case you're not understanding what I'm doing. Okay. Sorry. Everybody follow me? Okay. You know, I try to get too artsy sometimes with the way I talk. Okay. That's what they do. Five, and one is yet to come. Here's the problem. The next one to come is Galba. Galba reigns for like 7 months. Because Galba is in the middle of a civil war. We have what is called the Year of Four Emperors in 69. Where Galba ends up getting, not assassinated. Kind of. He's killed in front of a temple, but it wasn't like it was unexpected. He knew that the next guy, Otho, was coming. Otho only reigns for like 3 months. And then Vitellius comes in, and he takes over. Well, Vitellius, and this is all within 69. Galba comes to power in 68, at the death of Nero. But then in 69, Galba falls. In 69, Otho takes over. And then in 69 as well, Vitellius takes over. Well, in December of 69, Vitellius is overthrown. And a new guy by the name of Vespasian takes power. Why is he significant? First emperor of the Flavian dynasty. Who belongs to the Flavian dynasty? The next two emperors. Yeah, Titus is the older brother of Domitian and Domitian. He's a significant fellow then. That's the daddy of Domitian, who Irenaeus in the second century said the book of Revelation was written under. Notice, we're not even taking into account early church fathers. Hello? That might be a good idea. So, here's the issue. Who's the seventh emperor? Galba? Galba? That's the one we're afraid of? And here's my question. At Galba, did the destruction of all of Rome occur? No. What they a lot of times they do is they don't like Galba. So they'll try to act like these three weren't emperors and they'll switch down to Vespasian. Because that's the one they really wanted to get to. Well, problem is, all three of these were considered emperors. Just read Suetonius. Suetonius, the 12 Caesars, the lives of the 12 Caesars. Guess what? He counts all three of these. You want to know why? Because each of them was heralded as an emperor. It doesn't matter how long they reign. You can't eradicate the fact that an emperor is an emperor. It's kind of like, you know, our presidents. Even if they only reign a month, it doesn't mean we can't say, well, we're not going to count him as a president. No, he was elected. He was in power. He was a president. See the issue? So you can't get rid of them. A lot of times, though, some people will try to even figure this out even a little better to make it a little easier, and they'll say, well, let's just do Augustus then. Why? Because, you know, Caesar really wasn't an emperor. So the five that have fallen are Nero. It was written in the reign of maybe Galba, but, you know, sometimes they try to skip these as well. The problem is the seventh would be Otho, and he's pretty much not significant. So they try to switch over them, and they'll say six. Sometimes they'll even say seven is Titus. See what they're trying to do. Sometimes what they'll even do is to try and just kind of hodgepodge it. You know, we're just going to talk about the emperors only that were deified. And, you know, you'd have, a Caesar and an Augustus. And these two weren't. Claudius was, Nero was, so I've got four. He was, and he was. Who would be the seventh? Domitian. Ooh, that was fancy. But what are they, let's help me critique this. Help me critique this. What is wrong with what I'm doing right now? What are we ignoring? Yeah. We're ignoring genre altogether. Every other number in Revelation has been symbolically weighed, but all of a sudden we get to this one, we got to count. Another problem I have. What governs the number seven in John's? Why did John choose number seven? Was it because he's bound to history? What dictated the number seven for John? Daniel! Because there were seven heads on the beast. Right? That's not a number that he's like, well, I wish I could use the number 10, but there's only been seven emperors, so he's got to count them. No! That's not where he gets the number at all. He gets it from Daniel chapter 7. That's being ignored. Another thing that's being ignored is this. Why would the churches in Asia Minor need him to point out the date? Oh, I got to put this cryptic date within the book in case they forget who is reigning right now. That doesn't make any sense. You see what I mean? All of this starts to say, maybe we're not looking at this whole issue right. Maybe instead of measuring the numbers, we should weigh them. And the weight of the number is this. The prostitute is reigning. She has been reigning for five kings so far. What's that mean? Rome at this point is roughly, I mean, if you take it all the way back to Remus and Romulus, you're talking 800 and something years old. If you take it to like the Republic, then you're talking 600 years old, 500 years old. If you're talking the Principate, the empire itself, you're talking 200 years old. So, why am I saying that? Where am I at? What's happening? That threw me off. What?
Wait.
Yes. Yes. In other words, the five kings, she's been reigning a long time already. And you know what? She's still reigning right now. But guess what? Her reign is coming to an end. Notice what's the emphasis of the seventh king. What's the emphasis? The one that will come. But when he does come, what is it?
Short.
Yeah, it's really going to be short. In other words, if I'm marking the history of Rome on a timeline, most of it's over. That's what he's saying. See that? He's saying, yeah, this is five kings. We're in the sixth one right now. The reign. And you know what? There will be more to come of Rome. But it won't be very long. You see what he's doing? Why would that help the churches of Asia Minor? Yeah. But guess what? He doesn't say that there's going to be end to all kingdoms. He says, this is the end. We're talking about the end of the prostitute who has been reigning, is reigning right now, and will reign a little bit longer. And then someone else will. Kind of like Daniel. See what's happening? What is the question that we're asking in chapter 17? What is the fate of the prostitute? Not, what's the date of Revelation? You just abuse all the numbers and make them do whatever you want. And frankly, none of these make any sense with the social setting of the book of Revelation. Because they try to pick it back to Nero because they're like, persecution was happening there. Has it been told that we have a mass persecution of Christians happening right now? No, that the tension is gaining. There has been some, definitely in the past, even some in the present, but there's going to be a lot more in the future. That's what Revelation tells me, right? Because are all the martyrs, they're all ones that seem like they're somewhat in the past, which I think makes more sense if he's in time of Domitian, looking back to the last mass killing of Christians in the 60s, and then he's looking forward to the one that's about to come on the scene. It's not that there's not tension for the Christians to be wrestling with, because there is, through social seduction and other sociological factors. I know I'm getting into things that maybe you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. If not, just forget what I just said, okay? Yes?
I don't understand. You said it's the end of the prostitute, but not the end of, like, kingdom.
Right.
Yeah, I thought, like, this whole fall of Babylon and the woman and the beast is, like, it is showing a spiritual reality, like it's a promise that all kingdoms will fall.
Now hear me. You're asking about... There's a difference between the primary application and then the application to come. I would agree with you that it also is showing that spirituality, this is the fate of all kingdoms. I agree with that. But that's not the question in chapter 17. Because it's saying, what will come of the prostitute? And if the prostitute is defined, which will happen in verse 18, as Rome, then I need to allow it to speak to Rome first. See what I mean? Because... otherwise, yeah. I can't over-spiritualize it and not have it have any application to the first century Christians as a whole. I have to allow it to speak to the prostitute first. Do I think that Babylon becomes a metaphor for the other anti-Roman governments or anti-Christian governments throughout history? Absolutely. There's been many Babylons, and there are Babylons right now that are riding beasts and that will be devoured. I agree with that. But in the primary, whenever he says the seven hills, or he says it is the great city that rules over all the kings of the earth, if I'm in Asia Minor, that has one referent. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So the application beyond Rome, I agree. But that's not what the primary question is initially in chapter 17. And so I'm going to be addressing the primary application, right? That's what I'm addressing. Does that make sense? You following me? I thought I saw another hand. Anybody else? Have a question on that? We're not done with chapter 17 yet. It's nice and nasty. Also, I will say this. One of the other reasons why I don't buy into the whole Nero, it being at him the sixth, because we have the Nero, I believe there's precedent of the Nero Redux and the Nero Redivivus myth inside of Revelation, which means the Nero Redux myth was that Nero didn't really die. He faked his death and went away and will come back eventually to destroy Rome. Did you hear that? He'll come back eventually to destroy Rome. The Redivivus was that he really did die and that he will resurrect and come back and destroy Rome. And if there is evidence of that myth within Revelation in chapter 13, 12, 14, and then 17, 9 through 11, if there's evidence of that, of either one of those, then we would have to say that Nero was already dead. Because you can't have a myth about him coming back from the dead if he isn't dead yet. Right? See the problem? Again, this is just something I would say militates against the fact that he's the sixth king. But Galba is not a very good option for the sixth king either. And let me say this too. If there is persecution that is occurring or seems to be occurring in the book of Revelation, it would not be happening in the time of civil war of Rome. Why would I say that? Yeah, they got bigger things to worry about than this small little Jewish sect that of the leader that they killed on a cross a long time ago. Literally, all of Rome is possibly going to fall. If you read Tacitus and Suetonius, they even say that we were thankful for the Flavian dynasty. Even though they did not have noble birth, even though they didn't even have a good genealogy, we're thankful for them because they brought stability to the empire when we thought the empire was going to fall. Which I think may be the wound to the head of the beast, by the way. Because, man, this is crazy. Never before in the history of Rome, except for in the end of the first century BC, I'm sorry, 87 BC, around there, was there a civil war of this magnitude. Rome almost didn't happen after this. Because they're not just dealing with the Jewish revolt, they're also dealing with emperors fighting themselves. Blood was shed in the city of Rome for the first time in its history. Again, by other Romans. It was a nasty time, crazy time. They didn't know what was going to happen. And I doubt they're going to be going, in the middle of all this, let's deliver an edict to kill the Christians. Who are the Christians? You know, they're that small, really, 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 really small group that we just don't really like because they say some weird stuff. Let's kill them. That's what we need to do. It doesn't make sense. However, in the time of Domitian, I think it does make more sense. Anyway, okay. We need to keep going. I like that issue. But I need to leave it alone. Okay. Verse 11. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. What? Yeah, just let it play out. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom. Ooh, what does that tell me?
That
Think Daniel. What does that tell me? Another kingdom is emerging. The ten horns is ten kings who have not yet received the kingdom. They are different than the heads, even though they're on the head. You see, don't get too focused on the trees and you miss the forest. What's he describing? The destruction of the prostitute. So these ten kings emerge. They haven't received a kingdom, but for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. In other words, they are going to get a kingdom. But if one kingdom comes to reign, what happens to the previous one? What? It dies. It gets destroyed. Which brings me back to the whole point of chapter 17 to begin with, right? It would make sense that a rival kingdom would come on the scene if I'm going to talk about the destruction of the current kingdom. Verse 13, they have one purpose and will give the power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb. Sounds like the other beast. They're thinking, oh, a new kingdom's coming on. Maybe this is a good one. And then all of a sudden you get to verse 14. No, they're going to make war against the Lamb too. But guess what? The same thing that happened to the last beast is going to happen to this one. And that is, but the Lamb will overcome them. How would the Lamb overcome them? Think chapter 12. Yes, through the blood of the Lamb and the testimony of the saints that will not shrink from death. But will overcome them because He is Lord of lords and King of kings. That is actually a title that the Parthian kings gave to their kings, but Rome never gave to their own. The Parthian king was called the King of kings and Lord of lords. But the Roman king, we never have any evidence of that. We have him, he's the king of the world or king of all the rulers of the world, but never this phrase. The Parthians, though, they did. And who were the Parthians? Rome's mortal enemy. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. This will be recapitulated in chapter 19. What is chapter 17 recapitulating as well? The end of 14. And it's also 16. And it's also... But are we talking about Babylon? Are we talking about the destruction of everything? Yes. We're going to come to the end of the world again, friends. It just happened again. Okay? You following that? Yes.
Are you implying by him claiming the title of Parthia that he's positioned the land of the enemy of Rome? Is that what you're trying to say? Or?
Yes. I am saying that the people on the ground under the hegemony of Rome would smile whenever they see that their conqueror is coming and his name is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I think they'd be like, huh, well, we know what that means. Are they going to say that John is prophesying that Parthia will come and destroy Rome? No, it's what Parthia represents. The thorn in the flesh of Rome that ultimately could at any moment become the destruction of Rome. Parthia was greatly feared by the Romans. Constantly it's brought up. Matter of fact, whenever there were false Neros that were coming to be, there were. There was two or three of them within the first century. I say two or three because one of them is disputed. Two or three of them that actually rose up. One of them right around the end of this time, the Civil War. One of them at about 88 to 89, under the reign of Domitian. And the second time especially, all of Parthia gets behind this false Nero and is ready to follow him to go destroy Rome. See, Parthia was a major threat. The redux, the idea that Nero didn't die but he went away, where he went away to, they believe, was Parthia. That's what the myth was in Rome. I'm not talking Revelation, I'm talking Rome was afraid of Parthia like this. So whenever the conqueror comes as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, is it a bigger scale that he's talking about? Sure. But would the people in Asia Minor under the hegemony of Rome smile? You're darn right they would. Because they know what side he'd be on. You see what's happening? Allow the symbols to breathe. With him would be the Father. Blah, blah, blah. Verse 15. Then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and language. She's sitting on the world, everything. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to a ruin and leave her naked. Clothing in the book of Revelation talks to me about somebody's, not their ethic, but also their fate. Right? Jesus says in chapter 16, verse 15, behold, I come like a thief. Make sure I find you fully clothed and not naked. Why? Because what you wear, what your ethic will betray who you belong to and what your fate is. They leave her naked and they will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. What does that tell you about the prostitutes that even have existed throughout history and the beast that they ride on? If the beasts are a part of the unholy trinity, of the dragon and the two beasts, I'll just put B1, B2. If this is the unholy trinity, what does it say whenever the prostitute enters a relationship with these beasts? What does it say about it?
They're just a tool that gets discarded when it's...
Yeah. The prostitute's merely a puppet to accomplish what the unholy trinity desires, and that is war against the Lamb. And whenever that puppet becomes not useful anymore, they destroy it. They devour it. They eat the flesh and burn it with fire. Why? It's not necessary anymore. Get rid of it. And then they grab another prostitute and they begin to ride throughout history again. Now, I don't want to get into that. I've been too political today. Not in here, other places. Okay. For God has put it in their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. What did that just tell me? Tells me this. Even this trinity is under the hegemony of a greater trinity. Why? Because God put it in their hearts to accomplish his purposes. But their purpose, destroying the people of God as God's purposes, if that's how they overcome the dragon, he will allow it, friends. That's why Tertullian says, and I've said it more than once, and I'll say it again, that the seed of the church is the blood of the saints. Just ask the churches in India, whenever they say, don't pray the persecution stops, pray that we have stronger backs to endure. The churches in China, why? This is how we win. This is how we win. We need to be so dedicated to the kingdom that we're willing to stretch our necks out, even if they have a sword in their hand, and we say, go ahead and cut it off, because eventually your sword will be dulled. Because, buddy, when there's 1,000 of us you've killed, there's 1,000 more to come. So just come on, go ahead. That's why, you know, I will say this, and you don't have to agree with this, but it is a foolish argument whenever people... I can't do that. Okay. Sorry, not doing it. Verse 18. This is the revealing of the identity of the woman. The woman you saw, verse 18, is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Who is it saying that the prostitute is? Rome. That would fall, there'd be no question. And after verse 18, who the prostitute was, no question. Chapter 18. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He has great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird." That's actually interesting. Detestable birds, they were considered evil omens. And even the overthrow of a new empire. Matter of fact, when Vitellius, I was just reading this yesterday, in Tacitus, when Vitellius was at the end, whenever he heard that Vespasian's army was coming into Rome, he's giving a speech, and it says that as he's giving the speech, birds, evil birds, detestable birds, I don't know if I could use the word detestable because that's not what Tacitus uses, but not dirty birds because that has another connotation. Birds of evil omens became so thick, it says that it blackened out the sun. Isn't that interesting? The sun will turn like black, and the moon will turn blood red. It's an omen of the overthrow of a kingdom. Even in Rome. Even in Tacitus. But I want to tell you, what's happening right here in verse 2 is what's called a proleptic prophecy. Proleptic prophecy. What does that mean? Has nothing to do... Well, that's a terrible joke. Anyway. Proleptic prophecy. Anybody? It's a prophecy that's stated as if it's already happened even before it has happened, but they act as if it has happened already. In other words, he's saying, fallen, fallen, Babylon the Great. But when John's writing this, has Babylon fallen yet? No. It's proleptic. He's describing what the result will be in the future as if it happened right now to make his point of the assurance of what will happen one day. Because in a minute, the very next song that is sung in verses 4 and following, it'll start talking as if Babylon was existing in the current moment. Even though he's already just pronounced its fallenness. We've already heard fallen Babylon the Great in Revelation, haven't we? And I called that one proleptic. Even whenever I was talking to David at the just earlier in this class. Where was that? 14. Yeah. Fallen, Babylon the Great is the first thing that the bird starts crying out. Proleptic prophecies. It's very Old Testament-ish. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her. And the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excess luxuries. We're going to be talking about that in a minute. Even excess luxury, even though Romans indulged themselves in it a lot, they considered it something that was evidence of a vice in your life and not something that was of merit. And yet their emperors consistently engaged in excessive luxuries. But when you read Suetonius and Tacitus, that's one of the reasons why. That's their evidence of people like Caligula and their people like Tiberius and even of Domitian, of why they were considered such evil emperors is because of how excessive they were in their luxuries. They even believed in some form of moderation. Verse 4. Then I heard another voice from heaven say, come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. It's actually quite fascinating. Whenever Rome would be about ready to destroy a city, there was a precedent, especially in the first century BC, that they would have a guy that was come up and he'd be wearing a priest's robe and it'd be black and it would have over his face, he'd be covered in ash. And he would come up to the city and he would start pronouncing all the things that they had done wrong within that city. And if he would give them an opportunity to repent, and if they didn't, he said, because tomorrow we will destroy you. And he would go to their gates and he would go into the market and start pronouncing this. So the story goes. And after he was done saying, come out of her because she will be destroyed, he would leave, and the following day Rome would swarm in the city and wipe it out. And interestingly, we have a voice crying out to the people of God, come out of her, my people. Why? She's about to be wiped out again, like the fifth time in the book. Don't share in her sins because you will receive her plagues. Don't wear the mark. What you do matters. Come out of her is not a location. It's not a desire or a command or an imperative describing you to move to a different geographical location. It is an ethical challenge. Seven churches of Asia Minor. Come out of her and stop sharing in her sins. Because if you don't, I will come and remove your lampstand. Does this sound familiar? Recapitulation. He's saying the same thing over and over. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. What's her cup filled with? Blood of the saints. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. We're about to get into the most materialistic or materialism conversation in the entire Bible, this chapter. And that verse 7 is haunting. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. I pray the Lord doesn't say the same thing about us, you know? I pray we're using our money in a way that makes sense in the kingdom. Everything you purchase, whether it's a house or whether it's a car, if it's not purposed with a kingdom perspective or with a kingdom, if it doesn't work for the kingdom, and I don't mean in the sense of make fit, I mean in the sense of actually produce for the kingdom, it is superfluous and unnecessary. It's unnecessary. You hear my heart in that? Man, why don't we function off of the principle of enough? Why don't we do that? Why? Because I deserve more than that. I worked hard. And you're saying that the people that are in the field slaving away, they get a penny a day, aren't working hard? You don't earn luxury. You're a part of a kingdom. Everything you do, say, and buy should be used to build that kingdom. And if it's not, what are you doing? Who are you? It's an identity question. What are the luxuries of Rome used for? To build their kingdom. And their kingdom is based off of greed, cruelty, and lust. What kingdom are you building? So Shane, is it wrong for me to go bowling? No. Because that can even be used for kingdom purposes, can't it? Shane, is it wrong for me to buy a Ferrari? It doesn't make any sense to me. If I'm being flat out honest, it doesn't make any sense to me. At all. At all. Why? Because what's the purpose of that? And I'm not going to apologize for asking people questions that should be asked of other Christians. Does God really want you to have a Ferrari? Really? Explain that one to me. I mean, I know the Son of Man just walked. I get it. And I'm not even going against locomotives or anything of that nature. But I'm just saying, why not just function off the principle of enough? I don't understand. I'm confused. It doesn't make any sense to me. Am I saying you're going to hell? No. I'm just saying it doesn't make sense to me. And explain it to me, friend. Explain it to me how a car that could literally feed a Haitian for their entire life if it was sold, that you get to drive that around? At the same time, I will say this. It is so easy just to look at people driving the car and just judge them without even knowing who they are. And how dare you? You know what? You don't have a right to speak anything against anybody if you haven't actually talked to them and know their story. Shut your mouth. I get so sick and tired. Roger and I were talking about this the other day. I get so sick and tired of people lobbing bombs at these mega churches that are building buildings of millions of dollars. You know what? Do I totally understand that? No. At the same time, they're doing more for spreading the gospel than you will dream of doing. How dare you? If their building is being used for kingdom purposes, shut your mouth. At the same time, I'm a part of a church that's a mega church. And we did build a $5 to $6 million building. And guess what? Our leadership also committed that once the building's paid off, every dollar we paid for the building will go to missions overseas. And yet people will look at our building and they will say, oh, you guys, you're just all about your own luxury and yourself. This is a kingdom tool, friend. It's a kingdom tool. So watch your mouth. Some people will live in places where a $200,000 home will get them a one-bedroom apartment. So don't stick a number on what people need to function under. Some of us will spend 25% of our income on a car when somebody that's a millionaire will buy a Ferrari and it'll be 1/1000th of a percent of what he makes. Careful what you say. At the same time, if you get to know the millionaire in a way in which you have a relationship with him, you can look at him and say, why don't you sell that car and feed Haiti? You know what I mean? You follow what I'm saying? Am I speaking out of two sides of my mouth? No. It's called the tension. And you better wrestle with both extremes. But be very careful if you're like, oh, God's calling me to a life of luxury. Well, then don't read. You might as well just tear out Revelation 18. Or Matthew 19. Or Isaiah. Well, you get the point. If I'm going to err on either side, I'll tell you this. It's going to be the side that's non-luxurious than it is the other one. Because the other one, you're just playing with fire. Right? I mean, honestly, we're playing with fire. But you know what? It makes me feel good. Well, fire may keep you warm, but it can also burn the flesh off of you. All right. In that heart and in that tone, let's continue to read chapter 17 or 18. In her heart she boasts, I sit as queen. I am not a widow, and I will never mourn. Well, you little prostitute, it's about to end for you. Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her. One day. It's so ironic to me that, you know, that we have the modern day phrase. Rome wasn't built in a day. Yeah, but it's destroyed in one. You know? That's awesome. It will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. She says, I'm not going to have those, and then right after that he says, oh yes, you are. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. It is His hand. It is not just some random natural disaster here in chapter 18. It is the hand of God that is destroying her. When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Why? Well, two reasons, and we'll see them here in just a minute. Terrified at their torment, they will stand far off and cry. Number one, that verse tells me, they're upset and weeping and mourning because they say, if that's the one I've been hanging out with and all of my identity is wrapped up in her, maybe her fate will be my own. So terrified, they scream and they wail from far off. Whoa, whoa, go great city, great city, great city. Babylon, city of power, who is now burning. In 1 hour, your doom has come. If you were such great power, then how come it only took an hour to destroy you? Notice right there, though, the kings of the earth are upset, number two, not just because they could possibly share their fate, because what have they lost with her? Their own great power. The kings of the earth were using the whore for power. And now she's gone, and now they're upset. Not because she's gone, because they've lost their power and they may share the same fate as her. And that's what you're going to find, not just the kings of the earth, but with the merchants and with the others that follow in chapter 18. They're all upset because they're worried about their own sharing, their own fate they could share, and the fact that what they were prostituting her for has now been lost. They don't care about her. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. That's why they're upset. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones, and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood, and articles of every kind of made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cargoes of cinnamon, and spice, and incense, and myrrh, and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and cargoes, and the bodies and the souls of men. What is her cargo? Do you really think that all of the luxury comes with no cost? How foolish can you be to think that the luxuries that we experience and indulge ourselves with don't come at the cost of other people's lives? I just go to Walmart and buy it. Track it down. Because 9 times out of 10, the stuff you're buying is made by a little kid in a sweatshop somewhere that'll die by the time he's 15. I just look at the pornography on the screen. It doesn't bother me. Track it down. Because the pornography industry is what fuels the sex trafficking industry that children are trafficked in, thousands of them every year. But the luxuries I indulge myself do affect other people. And you can act like they don't, but you're foolish. And the people that don't think it affects anybody are the people that are usually at the very top of the food chain. Not the ones at the bottom, being used as the food for other people to eat. Notice her cargo is 28-fold. 4 times 7. They will say, the fruit you long for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off. They're not going to be close to her. And what are they? Terrified at her torment. Why? Because they may share the same fate as her. They will weep and mourn and cry out, woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, looks like a whore, and glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Kind of reminds me of Jesus saying, put your treasures in heaven, not where moth and dust can destroy it. What are the treasures in heaven that Jesus is talking about? People. It's people. What is the treasures of the strong man that Jesus wants to tie him up so that he can plunder? People. Man, I hope you're storing treasures in heaven. Because your treasures will be more population for all of us to get to know, a bigger community. That's the treasure. It is so ignorant to think that what you're working for down here is to get a bigger mansion up there. Are you really that dense? Am I? That I think that what I'm fighting for is more gold in heaven, whenever a place where that currency doesn't matter? Is that why you're in the kingdom? Because if it is, get out. I mean that seriously. If you think that why you are laying your life down for the gospel of Jesus Christ is so you can get a bigger mansion in heaven, I don't want you on our team. Because you're going to cause a lot of problems and hurt a lot of people. Because it's those people that we constantly could clean the messes up over. You know, we can have our greatest life now. Really? There's really only 7 steps to that? Doesn't sound like such a great life for the martyrs underneath the altar in heaven. But hey, they must just not have prayed right. Maybe they were just bad people and God was punishing them. That was sarcasm, I apologize, but it's necessary at some point. Every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, "Was there ever a city like this great city?" They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, "Woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth." Why are they upset? Because the whore's not giving them, she's not turning tricks for them anymore, if I continue the metaphor. In 1 hour, she has been brought to ruin. Rejoice over her, O heaven. I don't know why that is included in the hymn of the sailors inside of your Bible. It's not. It's the beginning of a different song. Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you. Chapter 6 starts ringing in my mind. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea, into the evil, into the chaos, and said, "With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No workmen for of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of a bridegroom and a bride will never be heard in you again." Why? Because your merchants were the world's great men. That's why. The people that you put in positions of prominence were the people that made the most money. That the people that you lusted after and longed to be like were the people that were on the Forbes 500 list. Why? Because you took merchants and made them the kings of your kingdom and not the prophets and the saints. Your merchants were the world's great men. And by your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In other words, he's saying, that's a lie. And yet, you know, I will say this. It is such a great temptation to even do that within our own churches, isn't it? Who's normally the people that are elders in our churches? The people that have made the most money. Am I saying they shouldn't be? Not necessarily. But I've seen many a church destroyed by somebody that tried to run it like a business and forgot that we have to add faith into the equation. Give me a Stephen. Give me a Stephen way before you give me a rich young ruler. Because man, Stephen will lead our church into glories we've never seen before. Not bigger buildings, but buildings that are functioning on all cylinders for the kingdom. Give me a Philip. In her, verse 24, was found the blood of prophets and of the saints, and of all who have been killed on the earth. Why was she judged? Because she exalted luxury. And the way that kingdoms accumulate more luxury is through the killing of people. Just trace it through history. It's a very simple political process. You want to make money? This is a simple political concept in our world today. You want to make money? Start a war. It's a very simple equation. You want to make money, start a war. What happens? Man, because if you do conquer, matter of fact, this was even advice that was given within the past 50 years, I'm not going to name names, from one country to another country that was struggling. The country economically was struggling, and they asked this greater country, and I'm using the word greater in a revelation sense, this greater country, how they can jumpstart their economy. And the advice was, start a war. Why? Because that's how luxuries are accumulated. You don't have colonialists going all over the world just because they're benevolent. It's because if people are under your power, you get everything they produce. It's a very simple principle. And that's what he brings up here at the very end. All who have been killed on the earth were found in her, all the blood. Man, she was rich. I'm going to take... Oh, it's already 3 minutes over. Two more minutes. Okay. After this, I heard what sounded like the roar of a great multitude in heaven shouting, "Hallelujah! Salvation and glory and power belong to our God, for true and just are His judgments. He has condemned the great prostitute who corrupted the earth by her adulteries. He has avenged on her the blood of His servants." He's answered chapter 6's question. The first question, not who will stand, but when will you avenge our blood? And again they shouted, "Hallelujah. The smoke from her goes up forever and ever." Notice what has prompted this worship service. The destruction of an evil nation. The 24 elders and the four living creatures fell down and worshiped God who was seated on the throne. And they cried, "Amen, hallelujah, let it be." Then a voice from the throne saying, "Praise our God, all you His servants, you who fear Him, both small and great." Then I heard what sounded like a great multitude, like the roar of rushing waters. Notice the great multitude. Where does that come from? Chapter 7, the rushing waters. Where does that come from? Chapter 1, whenever Jesus comes on the scene and His voice sounds like the rushing waters. And they sounded like loud peals of thunder. What does that? Where does that come from? Who do these people belong to? Okay. "Hallelujah, for our Lord God Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and be glad and give Him glory. For the wedding of the Lamb has come." We're at the end of the world again. "And His bride has made herself ready." How? Well, by wearing fine linen, bright and clean, that was given her to wear. But what is the fine linen? Fine linen stands for the righteous acts of the saints. And then John is a moron in the next two verses. "Then the angel said to me, 'Write, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb.'" Another beatitude. "And he added, 'These are the true words of God.' At this I fell at His feet," the angel, "to worship Him." What? "But he said to me, 'Don't do that, you moron. Stand up. We're in the throne room of God. He may see you. I'm a fellow servant with you and with your brothers who hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." Why does that word pop up again, the word prophecy here in 19? Yeah, because in chapter 1, what he was asking us to obey in the words of these prophecy, he is now bringing back up again. And what did he just tell us to do? Worship God. How? By going out to Week of E. Love you guys. See you in a week.